I figured that the 10 million is over now, so maybe we can go back and adapt the talks and the answers. There's something that was a little bit of a matter, but that we'll talk about it later. It's a lot to do with where we come from and how our thinking has distorted liberality. So, but we'll talk about it towards the end. So, let's give over to you for a moment.
Thanks. So, we divided the question into three parts. So, they will not follow the order in which each of the honorable members have asked them. There are project specific questions which Dr. Connor of is paid to answer and to do that. And then there are issues which are project specific, but they also have a broad departmental initiative that we are working on, for instance, the breakdown of the numbers and the recipient at the project level. Dr. Panarok will deal with that. At the broad policy level, we will ask Thomas to talk to knowledge centers, Honorable Kekana's question. And then there are a couple of other technical questions, the fracking question, Honorable Maseko, and the question around Honorable Lockett on the protection of the site and the impact it has on the local communities. So, with your permission, Chair, I will then ask maybe Ben Panner to start and then hand over to Thomas and then Val and then we'll just double check with the honorable members if they've all been properly answered. We may not have all the statistics and the data for some of the questions, and if we can't, we can either do that at the presentation next week, which will be about human capital. I saw the presentation, so we may want to bring the detailed steps at a broader level rather than at a project level next week if we can't, but we'll give it a best shot at this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here. Chairman, if I can be an opportunist then to start with a couple of things that were not in the questions. First of all, there's a lot more information which is available to honourable members from our website, which was on Val's last slide. And also, if you would like to get our newsletters, which come out four times a year, if you could speak to Lorenzo, we can do that either through email or we can send you printed copies. So please speak to Lorenzo after the meeting and we will arrange to get those newsletters to you. He's just working on our latest one, which will be out at the end of this month. But we can send you the previous one from March and the one before that. And I think you'll find it interesting because we try and have stories about some of the students and some of the researchers as well as the technology and science. Yeah, the other opportunity I want to take is one of our slides talks about big data as a $1 trillion industry. This is a new industry. It's an industry that's never existed in the world. And the estimates are that by 2020, this will be a global industry worth thousands of billions of dollars, not thousands of millions, thousands of billions of dollars. We are very well placed to play a leading role in that. It's not an industry where there are high barriers to entry. You don't have to build factories. You just need bright young people and some computer equipment. And you need people who are entrepreneurial and people who are excited about computing and big data. We can get a share of that. When we were with Minister Pandor in Washington recently, we said we're aiming for 20% of $1 trillion. And I think that's not unreasonable, but it requires a focused investment that you mentioned earlier, that you want to drive towards further investment in science and technology. And I think that's a legacy that this committee can take upon itself. I don't want to interfere with the DG's funding priorities, but he will excuse me if I just introduce this, because I think South Africa deserves at least 20% of that $1 trillion industry. Now, to come to the question, Seth, Germany, the Ministry of Education and Research in Germany, the BMBF, gave notice that they will withdraw from the board of SK next year in July. The representation from Germany on the board has been both from the ministry and from the Max Planck Foundation. The Max Planck Foundation funds most of the science research in Germany. So Max Planck at this point has said that they would like to continue as a member of the organisation, and they're negotiating with the Ministry and the German government about funding. Our feeling that Dr. Mdwaka and I sit as the representatives of South Africa on that board, our feeling is it's an internal problem within the ministry. A couple of years down the line, they'll have sorted out that problem and I'll come back. We can't guarantee that, of course, but that's what we think. And when we've raised it at board meetings, nobody seems to be too worried about it. And German industry is, in fact, talking to us. They want us to help them coax their own government. The haircut timelines were raised. We have very strict haircut timelines. As you know, the contract was given to a South African company called Stratasat, which is an affiliation of T-Satcom from the US and a company in Germany. Now, the detailed design is being done mainly from this company, T-Satcom. We did the conceptual design in-house, and we are leading very clearly on this project. So there have been some stresses between us and GDSATCOM because we believe that they haven't necessarily always put enough effort into the relationship with us. So there's been quite a lot of tension. We already executed penalties against them, and we are keeping up a lot of pressure. One of their problems was that they had to get South African companies on board because, as the DG and others mentioned, 75% of the value has to be spent within South Africa, so they have to get South African companies up to speed. I think they underestimated the technology transfer that is necessary, but they're doing that now. They've assured us that they will catch up with the schedule by next year, but we keep a lot of pressure on them, and our people go up and walk through the factories every year, in public, upon every week, to make sure that they're doing what they say they should be doing. So we are reasonably confident that we'll keep on track. The question was raised, will we have enough engineers? We've done the calculations for our human capital program of how many scientists and engineers we'll require for the Meerkat and for the SK in the longer run. And we've based our diversity program on that, but we also know that there will be a leakage. So if we train 100 engineers, 30 of them will go into the general economy, or 40 of them will go into the general economy. So we've always based our program on creating more people than we'll actually need. And we've seen some leakage. But as you saw in the slides, a lot of people are actually staying in the subject, which is very encouraging because many young people are excited by it. We're also through the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Council, working with the Department of Higher Education, Department of Economic Development, on the skills profile that will be required for the SIP projects. So our plan is done together with the PICC on that overall planning, and we're fairly confident that we will be able to provide enough people. There have been some things that we need to do better. So the question was raised about the racial breakdown, the gender breakdown, and the number of applications. We've now given something over 600 grants. Of those grants, about 19 have gone to students from other African countries, and we showed Philip Gibbett, for instance, from Kenya, who's now gone back to Kenya. We've had 20 students from Madagascar and so on. But the other students have been South Africans. Of the South African students, about 60% are black. Now, when you say black African students, I'll have to go into the statistics again to sort that out. But we can say it's about 60% are black students. And when we started the program, we thought that we would train only MSc, PhD and postdoctoral students. What we found was we could not get enough applicants for those bursaries who were black African applicants. So we then extended our program to be undergraduates as well. And we take some undergraduates straight from school. We take some from first year and some from second year. And in that undergraduate program, we target almost 100% to be black students and preferably black African students, so that we can move people up through that pipeline into MSc and PhD. But it's been very difficult to get students directly into MSc and PhD because some of the subjects are not subjects that a lot of people study. So like those rush boards that you saw, it's been very difficult to find black African students who study what's called digital signal processing. So we're having to create that pipeline. And we're taking that further. Next week we will be having the first session of what we call our Young Professionals Program. Again, we found it very difficult to get senior black engineers. We got quite a lot in our Joburg office in project management, civil engineering, electrical engineering and so on. But in this electronics engineering, it's been quite difficult. So what we're doing now is we're going to take the best students from our human capital program, from the Bristol program, and bring them into the organization, into the SKA office, and then have a career path for them to become senior engineers. So we'll be taking people in next year, but they're all coming to our Highlands office next week. We'll work with them for 2 days, find the best students, find what they're interested in, link them up with the different groups working in the office, and then take them through. And when you say, Chair, about extending the number of bursaries and so on, let me say, the more money you give us, the more people we can take in. So I'm very much the sort of person who follows the money. If there's money, you can do things. If there's no money, you can't do them. Chair, the gender breakdown, about one-third of our South African students are women. And that is better than you find in most overseas countries, but not good enough. As you saw among the in that slide of the prize winners, some of our best students are women, and also many of the managers that we have in the SK office are women. So in the slide that you saw of infrastructure, our manager for infrastructure is a woman. The manager of the Africa BLBI network program is a woman. Our human capital program is run, the manager is a woman. So we have taken a number of women. The head of our computer programming group is a woman. So we are very keen to take more women in. And as I've said in various forums, we find that women managers and leaders are more reliable and harder working than men. But I have to be very careful when I say that. So we take as many women into the program as we can. You can see a number of the prize winners there are women, and some very, very, very clever young women. So on the question of applications, how many applications are we getting? At the beginning of the program, when we started in 2005, we went to each of the universities and we did publicity. And then for the next few years, we advertised to the NRF website and we found a decrease in the number of applications. But now, for this year and from carrying on, we're going to the universities again to advertise, because that way we get more students, we get better students. So we have a decrease in the number of applications for PhDs. The data's going up again. We've also extended the program, because what we found was we could not get students from the Karoo into our bursary program. Not that we didn't give them bursaries, but they couldn't get accepted by the universities. As Al mentioned, there's very weak maths and science teaching in that area. So the kids don't have that qualification. So what we've done now is we've given bursaries to 42 young people from Carnarvon and surrounding towns to train as artisans at the FET College in Kimberley. And we've already committed ourselves to employing 16 of them as soon as they qualify. 3 are already employed, but we sent them back for further training towards artisan status, which is a 4-year training course. So they're doing national diplomas, then they do the in-service training with us. We hope to extend that program to our ambition is to train 300 young people from that area over the next few years as technicians and as artisans. And I think it's quite possible that we can do that. So we're getting good results, and you saw some of the on-site on-the-job training that we're doing. The question was asked about the design hub in the UK. The way the SK organisation works is that there's a head office which is awarded subject to a bidding process. So there was a bidding process, when was it, 3 or 4 years ago, 5 years ago maybe, which awarded the head office to Britain. Australia and South Africa both agreed not to participate in that bid. The problem is every country wants to be able to say we've got something from the SKA. So if we said, well, we can have the telescope and the head office, then it makes the others less enthusiastic. So at the moment the head office in the UK, in 2015 there'll be a new bidding process. And we know that the Netherlands, we know that Italy, probably Germany, and certainly the UK will be bidding again. So it's not clear at this point where the head office will be. The question was asked, is there a head office in the UK because we don't have enough design engineers and scientists here? Well, no, it's a political deal, if you like. In fact, as Val pointed out, in the design of the SKA telescope, we play a very important role in all of the design work packages. We lead many of them, and in the others we have identified key strategic areas to participate. Again, we try to lead everything, and people say, well, this is South Africa dominating, and I say, got to be a little bit careful politically. But we do play a key role, and we've got some of the best people, and that's acknowledged here. Many international people have said that some of the best engineers in the project and best scientists are the South Africans. And our team is generally accepted as being one of the leading teams in the world. And these are South African young people trained in South African universities who couldn't even spell radioastronomy 8 years ago. And now they literally are leaders in the world. And we can make that even more, because we can be world leaders in that science and technology. Chair, then, companies and status. I can't offhand give you a list of the companies, but we can produce that for you. There's two levels of that. One is the big national tenders that we run, where we run open tenders according to the NRF supply chain management policy. And that always specifies points for BEE qualifications, functional qualifications, ICE and so on, according to standard treasury regulations. Then in the local area, we've also included in all our construction contracts that the turnkey contractors have to contract local contractors. And we're working now on a program to train local contractors. So we have, I think it is 19 small local companies around the Karoo. And we've been working with SARS, we've had workshops with them at SARS, we've had workshops with them with the IEC, we've had workshops with them with the Construction Industry Council, and we've organized with the Kimberley FET College for an ongoing training program which will last 9 months, and they're signing up for that. So we've got very good enthusiasm from those local contractors. And we're about to award a contract to upgrade the road, and again, we'll do as much of that work through local contractors as we can. But we will put together a list of companies for you. I'm afraid it will take a little bit of time, but we will send that through to the committee as soon as we can. Chair, one of the issues in employing local people has been the skill issue. We did socioeconomic surveys there in 2007 and then again 2009, and we were about to do another one. But what is clear is that in that area, because there's been a very high rate of unemployment and not much economic growth, and the farms have been contracting, people who've got skills move down to Cape Town or Joburg for jobs. So when the contractors are required to go and get skilled people from the local area, they find it very difficult to find those people. And that's why we're emphasizing training technicians and artisans and other people in the local area. So it's been quite difficult to find people. There's some good contractors growing up, which are led by women, for instance. One of the leading building contractors in Carnarvon, the company is owned and run by a woman. And we're encouraging as much of that as we can. We're looking at a at a Working for Water program, which will be a woman-run program, which will take in a lot of women clearing the invaded trees on the site. And that's a long-term program because it's a beach site and there's a lot of trees. So that can lead to the downstream industry as well. The question of the funding talks. These talks have been ongoing for some years. There's now a process where the head office people will be visiting each member country, and they'll be visiting Dr. Jaffa and the team on the 15th and 16th of September in Pretoria to have informal discussions on what each country is prepared to put into the project. And that goes around two issues. One is how much money you'll put in, and the other question is, in what form will you give that? So many of the countries are saying, we don't want to give cash, we want to give in kind. In other words, we won't give you the money, but we'll build it for you and send it to you. Now, that's all very well, but you know, if four countries all want to build the same thing, it's not clear where you go. So those negotiations will take place first informally and then at the board. And the idea is that we want to finalise that by the middle of next year. So there's a funding agreement and a hosting agreement and what's called a project agreement, which would lead to a treaty between the governments, which sets out the funding requirements for the first phase. The second phase won't be negotiated now because we don't know the cost of the second phase. As Val showed in the slides, it will only be designed from 2019 onwards. That was all, Chair. No dark energy asked about. Oh, power supply, sorry. Chair, the uninterruptible power supplies that you saw in the photo, those are if the lines go down or if there's a drop in voltage. So because we're a national key point, we get preferential provision of power. We have built a new power line from Carnarvon to the site, and that can provide about 7 megawatts, 7 MVA of power. So we don't anticipate a problem. If there's a national blackout, obviously we'll be affected by it, but that's unlikely at this point, I hope. What we are more likely to have is when lightning strikes the line, either on the way to Carnarvon or on the way from Carnarvon to us, then you get these dips and spikes, and that can damage the telescope. So those UPSs are diesels, which are quite expensive to run, and they'll kick in very quickly just to smooth that and to store the power until the main grid power comes back. So we don't think it'll be a problem. Chair, on the question of dark energy, what we know now is that the universe started as a very small, very hot point, and that was 14,000 million years ago, and it expanded very quickly. And as you know, if you let the air out of a tire, the air gets cold because it's expanding. In the same way, as the universe expanded, it got colder. And after a couple of 100,000 years, it got cool enough that all these atomic particles could condense to form hydrogen gas, a little bit of helium gas. And then the universe continued to expand. And eventually, what we now know is that these lumps of hydrogen gas, together with dark energy, collapsed under their own weight and became compressed until they started burning helium like the sun does. So the sun, of course, is just a normal star. So the first stars then were much bigger than the sun. They started shining in the early universe, and they ionized all that cold gas. So that's called the epoch of reionization. So those first stars, we have a telescope on our side, which is not the SK, which we've been working with some American universities, which is looking for the sign of those first stars turning on. So what we know is that the universe has been expanding for 14,000 million years. About 10 years ago, scientists found out that the universe is not slowing down. You know, you'd expect if something starts to expand, gets bigger, it would eventually slow down and maybe fall back. What we now know is the universe is expanding and it's going faster and faster. So the question, what's pushing it to go faster? And we call that dark energy. It's called dark energy because we don't know what it is. You can't feel it, but you know it's there because you can see the universe being pushed by it. The same thing with dark matter. You know, the sun's part of the Milky Way galaxy, which is spinning. So if you spin a stone around your head on a string and you let go of the string, a stone will fly away. The same thing, if you spin the Milky Way and there's nothing holding the sun in, the sun should fly away, but it doesn't. So when you add up all the gravity from all the stars, it's not enough. There has to be something else there which we call dark matter. We know it's there because it has a gravitational effect, but we don't know what it is.
Before you come to you know, I said to him, he looks like a prophet. He denied that. But the way he talks, and when we are being a prophet, it's a subjective thing. Somebody sits down on the table without giving any answer and say, let's make him a prophet now. Because there have been so many people. But being a doctor, you want to write an exam, whether it's doctor of philosophy or medical doctor, you want to write an exam. So I think if you are not under Dr. Phil, you will be a prophet and you will be a prophet. Because it's a subjective thing. The way that you have explained it, though some of them are scaring on our mentality because he believes that he is a religious person. Now he believes that his God will make this thing. But now we are talking about the small bones that started backing out and there, and then he's telling him now, he's not going to go to church, you know. And coming to the final one, I think the Bible talks about the Eden, which I'm told was in Africa. And in Eden, it was the wife of Adam who said, okay, the snake added me to him and said, okay, let's eat so that we can. This is the tree of knowledge. So it is the female must lead us because they are the ones who started with the tree of knowledge. So that's why they are better scientists than us. That's why I say, and they should lead, you should allow them to lead because they are the ones who were taught by the thing that eat from that tree. Eat from that tree and you have all the knowledge and understand. And the other interesting thing is that I don't know why Josephine is not a teacher. You know, the first aeroplane is in Northern Cape. The first aeroplane is South Africa, landed in Northern Cape. Maybe we can research that. The diamond came from there. I think the defense force has been using Northern Cape quite often. It's a very important area for defense force. Now, even the transformation of the whole world is starting from Northern Cape. Maybe it's something that we've got to watch.
Jeff, can I just add something to what you say? I'm sorry to butt in on this. What we also point out every time we speak internationally is that not only is this new technology being developed in South Africa, but remember that human technology started in Southern Africa, in South Africa. So we always point out to people, don't be surprised that South Africa is leading technology. We've been doing it for 200,000 years.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to just respond on one of the items relating to the so-called community knowledge centers and a little bit at a more generic and policy level around transformation of human capital development. The Honourable kind of asked about knowledge centers, how many there are. Well, the department supports 33 science centers around the country in a range of different ways. This knowledge center, community knowledge center, is similar to science center. They have, the science centers are not all exactly the same. They have slightly different aspects to them. But most of them are involved in supporting basic education activities in the areas in which they work by providing platforms for teachers and learners to go and do things that they can't do in the school because the facilities aren't there. So they may have some laboratory equipment, they may have some computers, they may have some maths models there that the schools don't have, and the science centers provide them to the local schools. So some do this do this extensively and some do this only partly. Some do it at the high school level, some do it at the primary school level. So they're not all exactly the same. But there are 33 such centres that we support as part of our science promotion and outreach activities. And this is one of them. We also, the Scientific Astronomical Observatory in Sutherland, which is another one of our astronomy projects, they also have a local community science and knowledge center that they've established, also with a computer laboratory similar to the one that was shown here. So we have a range of these sort of initiatives. And in due course, if the honorable members wanted a presentation from us on our science outreach and science engagement and science communication activities, we could certainly do that. It would be also a full presentation in its own right. A specific example that you may have heard us mention before is the Tofimbaba Science Center that we're working on, which is the whole Tofimbaba project that the department is involved in is a demonstration project, a pilot project, of how technologies can be used to improve the quality of life in rural environments across a number of different things, including schooling, including learning. And so the Science Center fits into that particular aspect of the Tofimbaba experiment. And the Science Center in Tofimbaba, for example, we are working closely with the Department of Basic Education and the Eastern Cape Department of Education to talk about to finalize a plan around the funding of the Science Center. We have earmarked in the department already 11 million rand to build the Science Center. And we have agreement in principle with the Department of Basic Education and the Eastern Cape Department of Education that they will fund the balance of the construction costs. And they also understand that the long-term operations of the Science Center need to be supported by them because they will be integrated into the regional education programs and activities there. So we do have regular engagement with the Department of Basic Education around the sustainable development of a science center program. Clearly, it's not where we would like it to be in 10 years' time, but we're not in 10 years' time yet. We're here now. So we are working closely with those, with the national departments and on pilot projects with regional departments. Turning to the more generic transformation and human capital development initiatives, we will be presenting to the honourable members of the committee next week a more comprehensive overview of our human capital development initiative, and in that we will also be presenting some information on the transformation and equity issues, particularly of course where they are directly relevant to the programs of our department. But the picture is not quite as bleak as might have been the perception here. So for example, just a statistic I remember now, if I recall correctly, at the undergraduate level, the student enrollment pattern now is that 80% of all the students are black in the generic sense of the word. I don't have the breakdown into colored and black African and Indian students right now, but generically, that's a significant change from 20 years ago. What our concern as a department is that although that's a reasonably good statistic at the undergraduate level, as we move to postgraduate levels, that statistic drops and it becomes worse. So comparatively speaking, fewer black and specifically black African students move from an undergraduate to an honours, to a master's and to a PhD level. And this is, of course, a big concern for us as a department because it means that we're not developing our science system in a sustainable way. And so this is something that we're concerned about. We will be presenting to you next week an overview of some of the initiatives that we've put in place to address this specifically. But what I can mention right now is that, you know, when you ask people, why do you think that might happen, you get a lot of different answers. And we haven't been able to find a proper scientific study that actually analyzed this problem in a scientific way, went and interviewed students who have decided not to pursue postgrad studies and those that have. So we have in fact now commissioned, and it will be finished in this year, a study that looks at this in a very methodical way. So we really begin to understand to what extent do financial issues contribute to this, because we're quite certain that this is a very important part of what makes, what enables students to continue with postgrad studies or not, the level of state support. And it's quite likely that most of the students who continue to postgrad studies are from the middle class. And that automatically begins to impact on the racial demographics of your master's and your PhD students. But we don't know this for a fact. We surmise that this is so. So we're undertaking studies to look into that. Another thing that we have also started to think about, we haven't yet commissioned a study on this, we're going to be doing that shortly, is we want to begin to understand what happens to the graduates at the PhD level who graduate with PhD studies. We don't know. Even the universities struggle to find out what happens to their alumni, but it's a very important question, particularly in the context of transformation and equity. You know, we're investing in developing doctoral students, black fellow doctoral students, and once they graduate, we don't know what happens to them. To what extent are they absorbed in the system? To what extent are they able to continue adding value? To what extent are they part of the sustainable development of the system? These are questions to which we don't have clear answers. So we've initiated the process of beginning to identify, to get that information. So I'll be presenting, as I said, next week much more detailed information on this. Perhaps the last thing to just leave you with is that, and this links up to the question that was asked about the level of funding available and whether that would address some of the issues. We know that the National Student Financial Aid Scheme supports not quite, but less than a quarter of all the students in the public education system, undergraduate students. Our department is the biggest single source of funding for postgrad students. There are other departments that have funds, but we're the biggest single source of funding for postgrad students. And we are able, in terms of our funding, to support only less than 5% of all honors students, less than 10% of all masters, and less than 20% of all PhD students. So you can see that those are not sustainable levels of public support, particularly if you make the assumption that the individual level support that we give them, the values of the bursaries, are actually too low for them to be able to afford. And that's why it's really largely students from middle class backgrounds who have family support in addition to bursaries that they get from us that can afford to stay on and study. And this, we think this is a key issue. We have engaged with Treasury on this, and Treasury is very receptive to us in this argument. And I think that next year that we get an additional 400 million rand into our baseline for human capital development, because we presented this argument to them that we could, and this is not a specific answer to your question, could we use more money? Well, we know that we could easily support a lot more than 4-5% of honors students, 10% of masters and 20% of PhDs, because far more than that applies to us for funding. So A, the number of students we can support is much bigger than the ones we can afford to, and B, the individual levels of support that we can give them. An average master, an average PhD student, for example, I think the bursary is around 100,000 rand or something like that. And if you compare that to an after-tax salary of somebody who has a master's degree, you know, it would maybe be 180,000-200,000 rand. So this is what you have to compare. So they can't afford to stay at university because they forego too much income, which they and their families need, if they, especially from working class backgrounds or less middle class backgrounds. So these are some of the information that I will be providing you with a little more detail on next week.
There are two questions that I've lost, and the one is around the AGA Act and trying to limit the radio frequency interference, whether that has any effect on the local community. So if you look at the AGA Act, there's three different protection levels. So the first one is you protect the 10 kilometer, the core, and then you go a little bit outwards, and that's called the central around the advanced areas, that's about 70 to 80 kilometers, and then the coordinated advantage areas is about 300 kilometers. So you apply different protection levels in those three different areas. But generally speaking, we're looking at radio frequency. frequency interference that will interfere with the telescope, even the remote ones as well. And so what we have found is that the cell phone coverage does have an effect on the telescopes. So we've worked with the Vodacom and the CM, they're quite deep to this, and so we've come up with an alternative technology solution. In fact, there is a tender that's just gone out in terms of coming up with that solution. So there is a platform that we can use that uses a different frequency range, but then still connects up with the national coverage. So the affected parties in the area will be provided with alternative technology solutions. So wherever there is the community is affected, we will provide alternative technology solutions. But the cell phone one is just to keep one example.
The other issues around fracturing,
it's hydraulic fracturing. So essentially there's a potential of natural gas in the room, which is below bedrock, below the shale rock. And so the intention is to drill through the rock, and then you push in fluid at very high pressures. And what you try to do is to fracture the rock and the gas escapes, and you capture that. But the problem with some of these technologies that's been used for the mining, it creates radio frequency interference. So just as an example, some of the elite observatories around the world don't allow you to drive petrol combustion engines near the telescope. Because if you look at petrol engines, they have a spark plug. And when the spark plug fires, it creates a radio frequency interference, and which interferes with the dish. You know, so you can't have those kinds of machinery anywhere near your telescope. So you have to limit the type of machinery that you're going to be using with fracturing that might have an effect on the telescope. And that's when the AAA Act kicks in. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The problem is time here. Sometimes you feel that a day should be 48 hours. So that you don't hold this right. Unfortunately, maybe you should investigate and do a research on why it's not 48 hours. I mean, it's 24 hours. It's not 48 hours. And I'm told in Africa, the beginning of the year was yesterday, but one in Africa. First of September, it's the start of the year. Whether somewhat it changed to the first of January. So these are some of the questions that you have said. But in any case, I would request members, maybe let's try and edit here, and let's try and summarize. There is something that was said by you, one of the two members, which talks about some of the things we don't understand. You mentioned something, you don't even have a picture of what's happening. You reminded me of doing that in, all the way from rural areas of Transkei. They have told that when you aspirate an abscess from a person who's got an abscess in the liver, you get an anchovy sauce type of pit. Now, they're doing failure medicine. You've never seen an anchovy. You don't know what it is. All you know, you don't know. So, and then the lecturer tells you that it's an anchovy. So you say, imagine what it is. And you know what that was making. For the whites and probably Indians, it was easy for them to remember. But for me, it was very difficult. And in fact, I will definitely fail at the end of the year because I can't remember the anchovy. I can't remember even the name. Well, the other one, because at home there's anchovy sauce, you know what it is. And then when you see the results, which may be again, less than 30%, you say I'm stupid. And the other one getting 70%, you say this one is stupid. But you don't look at where they come from. And this is what we're talking about. We should be mature enough to understand. And in fact, what you were trying to explain, Roman, is the fact that you can do your research and commission it. But I think that we need to be mature about is that we were hit differently by different things. And we can't run away from that, really. If somebody was, this might be very sensitive, but if it's too sensitive, please pardon me. But it might be very sensitive. Somebody, I'm saying because I'm process speaking. Somebody was saying that you find every area that process speaking people, and they seem to have some knowledge. said the first birthday must sponsor and the second birthday must sponsor. Then you ask yourself why. But when you follow the history, you know, 1652, somebody came, it was in the cave. And most of the forts, that were what? The Fort Manor and the Fort, there were fought in the Eastern Cape with Tosa. And 200 years, they got into Nara, Gatenbach. 200 years after they were. So the Tosas were hit so hard that they had strategies of understanding how to build this fort. And then 300 years, they got to transfer. Now, obviously, when you look at those people, without looking at that, you see this one, the strategies of Jameson. Yet, it is the history that has made them to be like that. And now, if you are not mature enough, you want to follow that one. And this is what's happening, because we don't need to be emotional about this thing. We just need to say, okay, let us have caution, but make sure that we work towards making sure that everybody get as I said, and understand where they are coming from. Without living, without being emotional, things are going to be events. You don't make it an event, but you make it possible for everybody. And I mean, it's like if you take two kids, you're taking me or the Dadamatale from the Bobo, and you say he must attend in one of the schools, like where I come from, Otwendo. If I get a C from the school, it means if it was that this portion of it, what is it? This high school here?
Bishop.
I would be having an A. If I got a C from him, I would be getting an A here. Because of the conditions that I'm coming from. And these are the things that we need to be very clear about when we talk about this. And I'm saying this because I think science and technology is one of the areas that needs to unite us, and it is going to unite us. And this is going to make us a better country and keep up the good work that we have seen. We have heard, we have accepted, and I think it's our job as politicians to move around and find the way. And one important thing is to make you get more money if you can. But the prof, or I'm giving a professorial. But one thing that I know is that material things are done. If you get material things, it might not happen. But if you've got passion, if you don't have material things, it will happen. So sometimes we think that it's money that makes us go. And I think it starts with passion. If you're passionate about something, even if you don't have money, you'll find ways of doing it. But if you want money first, nothing will ever happen, and you don't have passion. So I think the passion is there. What a lot of people have for the department. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that passion is passed on to the member. You can see how they interrogate you. And we're hoping that they'll be able to answer for others. Because I heard one member telling me that when they allocate people, when they say you're going to sign them, they don't know, I don't want to go there. It's for learned people. I don't want to. But the real that I hear now, I want to say, no, it's easy. Even if you're not a learned person, if the illiterate person from rural area like me, or like that, I'm a child of who cannot be happy about this problem. No, thank you very much. Members, thank you very much. We'll go to LPA, we'll go to UWC, and I'll tell you.